Hello, and welcome to the Heathrow results for the 9 months to the 30th of September 2020. Throughout the call, all participants will be in listen-only mode, and afterwards there will be a question and answer session. And just to remind you, this conference call is being recorded. Today, I am pleased to present John Holland-Kaye, the Chief Executive Officer, and Javier Echave, the Chief Financial Officer. Please go ahead with your meeting.
Great. Well, welcome to everyone who has dialed in. I hope you and your families are keeping safe and well. I'm John Holland-Kaye, the Chief Exec at Heathrow. I'm here in our control centre at the airport on a lovely clear day. And joining me virtually are Javier Echave, our CFO, and Sally Ding, our Director of Treasury and Corporate Finance. Today, we'll present our financial results for the 9 months to September 2020, including progress on our three-phase plan in response to the COVID-19 crisis, a review of our financial position, which I'll ask Javier to take us through, and then we'll conclude by taking your questions. So let me start with an initial overview on slide 4. And as you know, the pandemic continues to have a devastating impact on aviation. I'm sure none of us have flown anywhere near as much in the last few months as we would normally do at this time of year. But the underlying desire to travel remains very strong. And the challenges that we have are the second wave of the disease, and particularly the attitude of governments to reopening their borders. And I think that is something that is starting to change. Now, when we last spoke 3 months ago, our passenger traffic had reduced to a low 96% below 2019 levels. And we did see an improvement over the summer months following the UK government adopting a risk-based approach to opening borders. That's something that we had encouraged them to do and was very welcome. But that recovery really stalled. It flattened out in mid-August as the second wave started and countries were put back onto the quarantine list. It's actually demand has stayed pretty constant since August, but we didn't see the continuation of growth. So we've reduced our outlook for 2020 and 2021. We're now forecasting 22.6 million passengers this year and 37.1 million in 2021. That's a decline of 54% compared to 2019 levels. And the key drivers are introducing testing in the first quarter of 2021 and then a vaccine towards the end of the year. So we are planning on what I hope will be a conservative basis to make sure that we can protect the business and come out strongly on the other side. We've been working hard to get our costs down and protect cash while working with the government and the international aviation industry to move forward towards testing. And testing forms just one part of a broader health and safety agenda. We can only remain open as long as it is safe for colleagues and passengers traveling through the airport. And we have spent a lot of time making sure that we can keep people safe at every point of their journey, and passengers can feel confident to fly. And the feedback has been really excellent on that. In terms of our financial position, our liquidity at the end of September was £2.4 billion of cash and committed facilities. But since then, we have taken actions to improve our liquidity even further. We have raised further funding, and also reintroduced the ADI Finance 2 level of our capital structure. And these actions ensure that we have liquidity for at least 15 months, even if we had no passengers. And it reduces our financing risk by pre-funding our debt maturities in 2021 and creates further headroom to our group covenant levels. We've continued to reduce our cost base to remain competitive and to be more flexible with demand. And financially, this has translated into a reduced cash burn. In terms of our strategic priorities, as ever, they are to deliver greater resilience, better service, and lower costs. We are also seeking a regulatory adjustment in line with the Q6 settlement. As you know, Heathrow is a price-regulated airport with a return set not by the market but by the regulator based on assumptions with limited upside and limited downside. And there was an explicit recognition in the Q6 settlement that it can be adjusted in the event of exceptional circumstances, which the CAA agrees has now occurred. And so we're seeking adjustment in line with the settlement, which will keep future consumer prices down, incentivize future investments to improve service, and give a sustainable balance of risk and return. And finally, climate change remains the greatest challenge facing society and our industry in the medium to long term, and we are taking the lead on decarbonizing global aviation. So moving on to slide 6, the progress on our business protection plan. And you'll see here the just how we have been reducing cash burn, a very significant reduction in capital expenditure, and then an almost equally significant reduction in monthly operating costs. And we're continuing to work on cost reduction, and Javier will touch on that a little bit later. And just to confirm, we are not forecasting any covenant breaches in 2021. So how do we fare compared to our European hub competitors on slide 7? Well, we are continuing to work hard to protect our business. We've actually been gaining market share over the last few months. We've continued to see incumbent airlines coming back. We now have about 80% of the airlines who are flying before COVID are now back flying again, but of course with much reduced schedules. We've seen British Airways and Virgin and some other airlines consolidating into Heathrow from their other London bases. Now, that may not be a permanent change, but it's certainly very welcome at this time and, of course, gives them greater cost efficiencies and better passenger service. But we're also seeing a number of new entrants coming into Heathrow, some of whom have been flying into other airports, but some are brand new to Heathrow, Indian airlines such as Vistara. And soon we will also have SpiceJet flying in. Both of these are important airlines in India who have not had the opportunity to fly into the UK in the past. So we're very pleased to have them coming in. But despite all that, we have seen our leadership position in Europe falling behind. And We announced today that for the first time ever, Charles de Gaulle has overtaken us as the largest airport in Europe. Now, I hope that this will be a temporary measure, but I think the key thing that they have benefited from compared to us is a much more progressive approach by the French government to introduce testing. And in fact, they were piloting pre-departure tests with some of their overseas territories as early as June. At exactly the same time that the UK government was ringing in its blanket quarantine. So that really shows a very different approach between the two governments. And I think this is a good lesson, both that testing can work, but that if governments don't get behind testing and reopening borders safely, then there is an economic cost to that. And we really want to encourage the UK government to get behind the aviation sector, not for its own sake, but particularly because it is key to the recovery of the UK economy overall. And I will apologize to any French friends and colleagues on the line if some of the reporting of that has seemed a little bit nationalistic. That tends to be the way these things get reported, but that's not the intention at all. So moving on to slide 8, where we talk a little bit more about what we're doing to get people flying again. Well, we've been calling for a common international standard for pre-departure testing since as early as April, and we are starting to make some headway with that. The Secretary of State, Grant Shapps, has announced that he wants to have a testing regime in place by the beginning of December. That would be very welcome. The government has set up a global travel task force to coordinate all the parts of government to deliver that, and from the calls I've been on with that team, it's the best example I've seen of joined up government over the past few years. So that's been a really good start, and it's been jointly chaired by Grant Shapps and by Matt Hancock, the health secretary. So that's a good sign that government is working together to get borders open again. And there are two things that we are calling for. The first is a post-arrival testing system that would apply for any high-risk country where people would arrive in the UK, go into quarantine, and then be allowed to come out of quarantine earlier than the 14 days if they test negative for COVID. The second thing we're pushing for is a pilot of pre-departure testing between London and New York. That's the busiest international route in the world. And there's a lot of momentum on both sides of the Atlantic to get it up and running. And I'm hopeful we might be able to do that by Thanksgiving, which is always a busy time for people flying on that route. And if not Thanksgiving, then certainly for Christmas. So two big moves that could get aviation moving again. And I think in particular, the transatlantic pilot could become a template for how people might fly internationally and start to move to this common international standard for pre-departure testing that we have been calling for. And you might be aware that we have been doing a lot of work at Heathrow to keep on moving forward the research into testing. We've set up both airside and landside testing facilities in both of our operation terminals. This is both to provide the gold standard PCR tests, but also some of the new rapid point of care tests. And in fact, the facility that we opened last week provides a private facility for passengers traveling to Hong Kong who are required to have the LAMP rapid PCR test, which they can get within an hour at Terminal 5. So that's a good step forward. But the fact that this is something that is relevant for Hong Kong, but it's not accepted by all other countries, including the UK, is a good indicator that we need some common standards to get international travel really moving again. So let's move on to slide 9 and just take a look at the future. And I talked earlier about how net zero is and climate change is the greatest challenge facing our world and in particular the aviation industry in the medium to long term. And we need to make sure that we learn the lessons from COVID, that we need to act soon, early, and see the early warning signals, because while we will recover from COVID, we will not necessarily recover from the climate crisis. So we need to act soon. And aviation has always been excluded from global climate change treaties. And we have taken a stand that says that we shouldn't be. We need to take the initiative to decarbonize global aviation by 2050 in line with the Paris Accord on climate change. And the biggest change that we need to make is in the fuel source. You either change the plane or you change the fuel. And it's much easier and quicker to change the fuel source from fossil fuel to sustainable aviation fuel. And we're encouraging the UK government to make aviation a centerpiece of the COP26 climate talks held in Glasgow in November 2021, ahead of a potential global agreement at ICAO in September 2022. And there's actually been a lot of momentum building along that. I'm involved with the government's Jet Zero Council, which is looking at how we can deliver this, and have also taken part in the ICAO sessions, which have been starting to build towards that summit in 2 years' time. So things are gathering momentum. And there have been some real significant changes that have been happening. We've been lobbying the government and other governments to prioritize sustainable fuels for aviation, to set an increasing mandate for sustainable fuel use, which sends a demand signal to producers, and to use some targeted investment to stimulate supply. But even during COVID, we have seen the industry really starting to shift its thinking. And really, I'm hugely impressed by the lead that the One World Alliance has taken in following British Airways in committing to net zero by 2050. And this is significant because it includes the biggest airlines in China and the USA, as well as airlines in the Middle East and Russia. And that really shows that there's a global groundswell of support from the people who are providing the demand. And on the supply side, we've seen global energy companies such as BP starting to transform their businesses away from fossil fuels. So there's a real sense of momentum coming here on supply and demand that can give us hope that if we keep on pushing, that we really can achieve the decarbonisation of aviation globally. Now, we launched our own Heathrow 2.0 sustainable growth plan a few years ago. Our targets are completely aligned with the UN's sustainable development goals, and we're making good progress towards them. And we were lamenting, many of us, the loss of the 747s as they came to the end of their runway. But actually, it is part of a plan that we We discourage, through our pricing system, airlines from bringing their noisier, older planes to Heathrow and incentivize them to bring their cleanest and quietest planes to Heathrow. And the 747 was certainly at the noisier and dirtier end of the spectrum. So it shows, I think, that the industry is working together to get to the right place. And sustainability is not just something for me and for the sustainability team. It is the responsibility for the whole organization. And Javier, our CFO, has really taken a lead with getting heavily involved with the Prince of Wales's accounting for sustainability and leading our move towards the Task Force for Climate-Related Financial Disclosures, where we have achieved an intermediate level in 2019 and are targeting to achieve full disclosure. And I know that's an important issue for many people on this call. And then finally, with regulation, I've touched on the call we've made for the regulator to do what it said it would do by adjusting the settlement in the light of the exceptional circumstances that we face. And they do acknowledge that these really are exceptional circumstances. But just to give some context, any adjustment that might take place would be smoothed over a number of years to minimize the impact on consumers. And in fact, aeronautical charges will come down in 2021 just as part of our normal regulatory settlement. But I think what we're proposing is fair, and it makes sure that we can provide better value for consumers in the long term. So now I'll hand over to Javier to take us through a review of our financial performance.
Brilliant. Thank you, John. And welcome to everyone who has joined us today. I genuinely hope all of you are keeping safe and well. And I will now share with you an overview of financial performance starting on slide 11. So as John mentioned, over the last 3 months, we have served on average 84% fewer passengers. And while this is an improvement to what we have seen for Q2, the improvement is quite minimal. This deterioration in traffic volumes has led revenue to decline by 72% in the third quarter alone, with aeronautical and retail revenue suffering the most. In terms of cost, over operating costs declined over 30% in the quarter, reflecting the compounding impact of rapid actions that we management took to reduce our cost base. Altogether, revenue and cost means that adjusted EBITDA declined by 93% to £37 million, slightly better than the negative EBITDA we saw earlier in the year. Moving on to below EBITDA, we have booked an exceptional charge of £188 million, with around circa £80 million of which impacts our cash flow in the period. These exceptional items include two things. First of all, £103 million related to our people restructuring program. And second, an £85 million write-off of previously capitalized costs, as some projects were either put on hold or were unlikely to resume in the short term as a result of COVID-19. It's worth reminding that this is an accounting write-off within our income statement, but we expect that all of these asset costs will be fully recoverable through our regulatory framework and are still included in our regulatory asset base. Apart from these exceptional losses, we reflect also in our accounts the non-cash fair value movement of two items. The first one is the fair value of our investment properties, which has deteriorated by £278 million from December, and that's primarily reflecting the temporary loss of trade in our car parks. The second item is the negative fair value of our financial instruments, which relates to the prudent approach that we take to some of our risk, and we put in place some swaps to really offset the volatility created by either interest rates, cross-currency movements, or inflation swaps. Some of them, we don't have hedge accounting because the interpretation of IFRS 9 is still not clear. And for that reason, the value in the P&L is deteriorated by £265 million. Combining all these elements together, lower trade, exceptional charges, and negative fair value movements on properties and financial instruments, our loss before tax increased for the 9 months of the year to £1.5 billion, which is obviously a substantial amount and a reflection of how devastating COVID has been for the business. Despite these record losses, we continue to benefit from a robust balance sheet and a strong liquidity position, which ensures that we are able to overcome this crisis when the market recovers. Moving on to capital expenditure, we spent £370 million, which is 43% less than last year, and the rationale for that reduction is precisely to protect liquidity. This is also the reason why you will see a slight decline in the balance of our regulatory asset base. We continue benefiting from strong liquidity position, as John and I mentioned earlier, with £2.4 billion of cash within the Heathrow Finance Group at the end of September, or £4.5 billion of liquidity taking into account the additional funding raised in October and the capital injection from ADI Finance 2. As a reminder, we have circa £400 million of cash held at Heathrow Finance, which will cover 4 years of debt service until the next maturity in 2024. Moving now on to the details, let's start with revenue in slide 12. So overall, revenue fell by 59% in the first 9 months of the period, or 72% in Q3 alone. Aeronautical revenue, going component by component, declined by 62%, driven by a rapid deterioration in passenger numbers. And as you can imagine, revenue per passenger metrics in this current environment is largely distorted by the minimal passenger numbers that we serve. So to illustrate this, average aeronautical revenue per passenger increased by £5.30, as many of the current aircraft movements are with low load factors or cargo only, which are charged on a per movement basis. It's remarkable that they are taking cargo only movements, which has led to an increase of over £40 million in cargo revenue this year. Moving into retail, retail revenue declined by 63%, again driven predominantly by reduced passenger numbers, and many of our non-essential outlets closing earlier in the year due to the government guidance. Finally, as other revenues, they decreased by 42%, demonstrating relative resilience in other related charges collections, as well as property and other revenues. Moving on to slide 13, and to give you a bit more detail on our cost base, our costs have decreased by 18% in the nine-month period, but by over 30% in Q3 alone, reflecting rapid actions that we took to reduce our cost base. This means that we have now secured around 200 million of the at least 300 million efficiencies that we committed at the start of the year. We are remain confident that we will meet at least 300 million of savings by the end of 2020. However, given our revised outlook, it's clear that we need to go further in reducing our costs, especially given the lack of government support on waiving business rates. This means that it's essential that we ensure people costs are aligned to market rates, for instance, and we will also look at our operational setup flexibly, including the opening of additional terminal capacity, as well as we will continue exploring every single option available to reduce our costs. Not every single option, the one that we will never compromise is, as you can imagine, safety and security. Whilst it's too early to quantify the additional reduction in costs that we are exploring, we will, of course, remain transparent via the usual channels, such as our December investor report. But what I can really say now is that it's time to adapt. I think COVID is going to be with us for a few years, and we must adapt to our new trading environment. And that means changing the way we work to become more flexible, agile, and competitive, so that we are best placed to transition into the winning the recovery phase that we are all so much looking forward to kick off. Turning to cash flow on slide 14, obviously with some of the things that we have discussed today, it will not come as a surprise that our cash flows continues to be severely impacted by the loss in passenger numbers and the associated revenue of that. So this means that cash generated from our operations has declined by 85% compared to a baseline of 2019. Using the cash generated from operations alone, we are now not in position to cover our capital expenditure and interest payments, and the shortfall is currently met with the cash retained within the business and results in a higher net debt. This is a distinct reminder that we need to continue fighting to preserve our liquidity, as well as a signal of shareholders' strong and responsible support through this crisis. I hope you all would agree that the actions we as management have taken are reflective of this priority, and I will talk a little more about further initiatives we have implemented in this space in a moment. Dividends are exactly the same as disclosed in Q1 and in half of the year. £100 million was paid to ultimate shareholders in the early weeks of the year, reflecting the strong cumulative performance that we saw back in 2019, and obviously before the significant impacts of COVID became evident. Considering also that we have exceeded certain early warning thresholds that have triggered a distribution lockup, Heathrow has stopped paying dividends in the foreseeable future to protect creditors. As mentioned already a few times today, we have recently restored the fourth layer of our capital structure that existed previously until March 2019. In October, we signed a £750 million facility that will be drawn before the end of the year. Proceeds from ADF Finance 2 will be injected into Heathrow Finance Group and partially used to repay some debt on Heathrow Finance. The remainder, which will be around £600 million, will be injected into the Heathrow SP group and used for general corporate purposes and to reduce our gearing by around 4 percentage points of the ratio to RAB. Taking into account all other outflows in the period, together with this net capital injection into Heathrow Finance, the net debt is roughly aligned with the position at the end of 2019. Turning to slide 15 and for a look at how we have strengthened our financial resilience. So from last time we met as a group in as part of the H1 presentation, you know that we have followed the same three phases with regards to our financing platform. It's exactly the same phases that John described at the start. First of all, it's about protecting our business. And in financial terms, that means protecting liquidity and protecting debt covenants. So in terms of preserving our cash position remains absolutely paramount in these extraordinary circumstances. And as you can see, our current strong position reflects both prudent management action as well as a long-term support from our shareholders that has been holding liquidity in the organization for many months prior to the crisis. To strengthen on top of that this liquidity position, we took the prudent and proactive step to access the euro, sterling and Canadian dollar bond markets in early October, raising around £1.4 billion sterling equivalent via three transactions. This effectively means that we have now completed the funding plan that we mentioned previously and have managed to pre-fund in full our 2021 debt maturities. Obviously, this is a fantastic opportunity to thank again all of you, our lovely creditors, to continue supporting us in this time of crisis. On top of that, the capital injection from ADI Finance 2 helps to provide further headroom to our group gearing covenant level. And when you add all these features together, we can meet all our forecast needs for at least 12 months under the extreme stress test of no revenue, that obviously we are not expecting to face that scenario, or well into 2023, under our current traffic forecast. This obviously includes in our projections forecast operational cost, as well as capital investment, debt service, and debt repayments. The final piece within this phase of protecting the business, we have restructured some of our swap portfolio to reprofile our interest expense for the following years. This prudent step will contribute to creating more headroom for our credit metrics over the next couple of years while traffic recovers, especially interest cover ratio. For the next phase, winning the recovery, we are focusing on a few things. First of all, we remain committed to restoring A- credit metrics in the medium term as soon as this crisis is possible, and we remain in a constant dialogue with the rating agencies to ensure that they have full visibility and transparency of the situation, the financial position, as well as the actions that we are taking. You may also be aware that earlier this month, the rating agency Standard & Poor's maintained our investment grade credit rating and extended the credit watch with negative implications. In their report, they recognized the strength of our liquidity position and as well as the actions that we management have taken to mitigate the impacts on leverage and interest bill. Moving into the last phase, building back better, we haven't forgotten about our ESG commitments, and this, as John has described before, they are only going in one direction, which is more and more robust. So over the last year, we have accelerated engagement with investors on ESG and share our sustainability agenda. We are encouraged by the appetite that all of you and your organizations are showing for more sustainable financing, and we really welcome the increased requests for calls with our sustainability experts as well as anyone with Heathrow, because as John mentioned, sustainability is not just for the sustainability team, but for every single citizen within Team Heathrow. We continue working to integrate Heathrow 2.0 KPIs further into our financing plans. And the next stop for us, we are planning to obtain a formal ESG rating in the medium term. Turning to slide 16, obviously we continue monitoring very carefully headroom to key ratios under our revised traffic forecast. If we go one by one at Class A and Class B, the headroom to gearing trigger events remains comfortable, whilst at Heathrow Finance, the headroom to gearing covenant has reduced significantly. The risk of breach has now been removed in the short term by early and prudent steps we took in securing a waiver with your support. And beyond this, the capital injection that we are announcing today from ADI Finance 2 will provide further buffer to covenant levels. These higher regulatory asset ratios are the result of a slower RAB growth, as alluded earlier, and our efforts to prioritize liquidity during the crisis. With regards to interest cover ratios, as of 30th of June 2020, our forecasting event and trigger event have occurred as previously anticipated in the June investor report in relation to the forecast ICR ratio for Class A and Class B for the 2020 financial year. As a consequence, a distribution lockup is in place within Heathrow SP and will have no adverse effect on Heathrow SP's creditors. In fact, it can be seen as a protection as it locks cash within the ring-fence group and distributions cannot be made to Heathrow Finance to service debt, nor to pay dividends to ultimate shareholders. On parallel, Heathrow Finance also benefits from strong liquidity, which is £400 million, sufficient to service debt for years with no maturities until 2024. So as you will remember, the Heathrow Finance ICR is waived for 2020, and based on the outlook that we are announcing today, we forecast no breach in ICR covenants in 2021 under our revised forecast. Finally, I'm moving on to slide 17 to conclude the financial section of the presentation. Let me share with you the outlook that John pointed earlier. We recognize, obviously, the current volatile markets and the recovery is expected to be much more gradual than we previously forecast. We are therefore revising our guidance for both 2020 and 2021. Starting with 2020, we are now forecasting 22.6 million passengers, which is 6.6 million passengers below our previous guidance, or 72% down compared to 2019. Obviously, given this downward revision in passenger demand, we expect the impact on EBITDA to be around £70 million below our June guidance for 2020, or to around £290 million. As you can see, management initiatives to reduce cost burn and maximize revenue has enabled us to reduce the impact of the passenger shortfall and will also flow into 2021, where we are downward revising the passenger forecast to 37 million passengers. That is 26 million below our previous guidance. Despite the more challenging outlook ahead, we forecast no breach of covenants in 2021, thanks to mitigations discussed, such as a capital injection from ADI Finance 2, swap restructurings, and further cost reductions that we are executing as we speak. Some of these additional cost initiatives will include full year savings of the actions we have already implemented only for 9 months in 2020, as well as consolidation of terminal operational spaces for longer, and a full year benefit of market aligned terms and conditions that we are currently finalizing with our union partners, just to mention a few. Obviously, we will provide you full financial details and forecasts as part of the December investor report, currently scheduled for mid-December. So with that, I conclude the financial review and I hand back to John for closing comments. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Javier. And let me just move on to slide 19 just to wrap up. And we are obviously in a world where aviation is going through a significant downturn and many businesses will be in crisis. But the financial support that we have in place and many people on this call have helped us with this, give us the confidence that Heathrow will survive through even the most difficult circumstances and be in a strong position to recover at the end of it. And critical for us is to, in spite of all the changes that we will have to go through over the coming months, we remain true to our values. And the start of that is, of course, about passenger service. That even if our passenger numbers are only a quarter of what they might have been a few years ago, all of those 22 million passengers expect to have an incredible service going through Heathrow. And that is the thing that we are most focused on. And I was pleased to speak to a journalist earlier who told me that from the plane docking to getting onto London Underground took him only 13 minutes the other day, which I think is a fantastic experience, given that many processes take a little bit longer, particularly on the arriving journey, than they used to. So a good sign that we are getting the service on focus right. But the four priorities, which we have talked about before, Mojo, making Heathrow a great place to work, always challenging at times like this, particularly with so many people worried about their own future, their own health, their families. We are really focusing on protecting jobs. We're an important local employer, and we want to make sure we can protect people's jobs as much as we can. So while there have been compulsory redundancies among our management team, there have not been in frontline roles. And when faced with the choice of cutting legacy pay or cutting jobs for frontline workers, we have chosen to cut pay while still remaining an employer paying above the London Living Wage. So we'll continue to be a good employer. But our values are helping to guide that kind of decision. I've touched on transforming customer service, and the nature of customer service has, of course, changed with an increased focus on health and safety. And we'll keep on adapting our service to make sure we keep people safe in the journey. Beating the plan is very much around systematically driving our costs down now, so that as we come out of this crisis, we are in a more competitive position, because it will certainly be a more competitive market. And then finally, sustainable growth, Javier has touched on. I'm an optimist by nature, and even with the passenger numbers we are looking at for next year of 37 million, that is almost twice as many as we have had this year. And we are back into being a growth business. In the longer term, we would hope to continue growing beyond the two runways that we currently have. But we will only do that provided we can do so sustainably, and in particular continue to lead the move of the global aviation sector towards a net zero by 2050 goal. So hopefully that gives you some confidence that in spite of the challenges we face, we are still the same Heathrow with the same values, and we're very grateful for the support that you give us to achieve that. So let me now close the formal part of the session and open up to any questions you might have. So, Jerry, would you like to just open things out?
Thank you. If you do wish to ask a question, please press 01 on your telephone keypad. If you wish to withdraw your question, you may do so by pressing 02 to cancel. And our first question comes from the line of Sharon Vitton of Columbia Threadneedle. Please go ahead.
Hi, Sharon.
Hi, John. Thank you. Thanks very much for the presentation and the details provided. I've got four questions, John, if I may. The first one is on the forecast for 2021. That's down quite significantly from the numbers we were given earlier this year and at the time of the consent solicitation as well. So the waivers are obtained on quite different assumptions, and it feels like December is quite a long wait to be given some sort of idea of what things might look like. Do you at least have a likely range of some parameters for the net debt to RAV ratios, or at least an EBITDA number or level for 2021? The second question is the 54% drop for 2021. That, am I correct in what I heard? That factors in a testing regime in place by the first quarter of next year, the introduction of a vaccine later in the year. It does seem so much worse than your earlier guidance as well. So perhaps is there something I'm missing? The third question is the added to capital injection, which is very positive, but is that enough for the CAA to reconsider the request to adjust your RAB upwards in the short term? I mean, looking at the publication they put out a couple of days ago, they seemed quite negative on that. And then finally, at what point will the rating agencies look to change their ratings for Heathrow or indeed the whole airport sector? I mean, what would trigger their worst outcomes here? That was all.
Great. Sharon, great questions, and I'm sure that there are questions that others have. I will ask Javier perhaps to come in on 1, 3, and 4, but perhaps if I can just touch on the forecast first. We have the forecast model that we've put together looks at our top 40 markets, looks at the development of the disease in each of those countries, the propensity to fly for the three different passenger groups in each market, which are visiting friends and relatives, tourists, and business passengers, and then looks at the kind of controls that are in place around the borders. And it's a model that we developed before the June forecast update, and actually through until the middle of August, it was tracking bang on with the forecast as markets started to open up as we had expected them to. What changed, and we started to see this through the middle of August, was the second wave starting to come in, and so we've been reviewing our forecast, taking stock of what's quite a fast-moving situation with countries responding in different ways to different spread of infection in each area, and it is a fast-moving situation. And in fact, it's only last week that both Canada and Ireland, who have been two of the more conservative countries in terms of controls, have announced that they are moving to testing. So our forecast can only ever be valid at a particular point in time, given the huge uncertainty we have. But we felt it was better at this stage to be on the more conservative side, if anything. I think there's a good chance that testing could come in sooner. It's very hard to be specific on that, but I think there's a good chance that it could come in sooner. But from our own planning point of view, we need to be cautious. These are uncertain times, and we tend to have all been surprised on the downside. And so it's better to plan for the worst and hope for the best. And that's very much the approach that we have taken. In terms of the 20 impact on 2021 EBITDA and any ratios, we are still going through our detailed planning process, which we'll be signing off with the board at the end of November. And after that, we'll be able to update in the December investor report on what we think the financial implications would be. But we are really taking a hard view on and a very conservative view on cost to make sure that we get our cost base down as far as we can, just in case the market remains very difficult. And I think that's exactly what you would hope we would be doing. But Javier, let me pass over to you to add any more comments you want to make on that, and equally to cover the other good points that Sharon raised.
Great. Well, Sharon, thank you. So I think just to complete, hello, Sharon. Thank you for your questions. Brilliant questions, actually. John, give me a couple of seconds to try to think about how to answer you. So I think just to complete what John has just mentioned, in terms of forecast 2021, as John mentioned, we will publish all the details as part of our investor report. It's currently scheduled for the 18th of December. But one of the things, there are two things I want to give you comfort today. One is that our forecast, we are not forecasting any breach of covenants in 2021. and therefore I just wanted to give you comfort. And the reason for that is because, as you can see, among one of the things that we are already implementing is the capital injection from ADF Finance that we are announcing today. From a gearing perspective that you were specifically asking for, the capital injection is equivalent of resetting our gearing back to December 2019. So we have restored 9 months of underperformance in 2020 with this capital injection. So that combined with other cost mitigation, swap restructurings, and other things that we will disclose in full detail, give us the comfort that we are not forecasting breaches for 2021. The other two questions, the second question was around ADI Finance 2, capital injection, and the CAA request. I think one of the things that we have been clear to the CAA, and we will be more clear in our response to the consultation, is that what we are discussing here is nothing to do about balance sheet or capital structure. It's purely a conversation around risk and return. And you know, Sharon, you are a very experienced investor in infrastructure. In private funded investor regulated businesses in the UK is predicated on a RAF model. And that RAF model is generates low return to shareholders simply because they get limited upside as well as limited downside. And under those rules, Hydro has completely transformed over the last 10 years. Investors have been putting £12 billion of capital to restore all the service that we have at Hydro. Today, Hydro is one of the most competitive global hubs in the world. And that has been predicated on a simple rule, a rule that is a RAB-based model where risk and return is properly balanced and efficiently incurred investment is securely payback. What we are asking the CAA is not something difficult. It's simply to enforce what's in the current settlement. The settlement already prescribes that under exceptional circumstances, the settlement can be reopened. And this is precisely what we are asking the CAA. So we are not, in our view, this is nothing to do with the balance sheet or gearing. That's just a consequence. But it's simply a matter of risk and return. And also it's worth reminding that the CAA has specific statutory duties for consumers and financeability. So obviously we are confident that as part of our response and as part of this consultation, the CAA will reconsider their position. And obviously behind the scenes, we continue proactively working with them to try to find the right solution primarily for consumers. Your final question on rating agencies. As you can imagine, we remain open with talking to them very, very frequently. If I cover the rating, the three of them individually, Standard & Poor's, they have already done their second review. The first one, they downgraded us by one notch, and the second, we are in credit watch with negative implications. As you can see in the report, they will be monitoring very carefully traffic forecasts. The traffic forecast that we are using today is already well known by Standard & Poor's, and they have they will take stock again in 3 months' time. With the other two agencies, Moody's and Fitch, they continue reviewing their traffic assumptions, and again, we're remaining in frequent dialogue with them. So obviously, I think at this stage, we don't anticipate imminent rating action, but obviously you will agree with me that we are living exceptional volatile circumstances. And obviously that means that as management, we need to continue pushing for sustainable efficiencies to ensure that we can minimize the impact on credit as much as possible. I hope that answered all your questions, but please follow up if that wasn't the case.
No, that's great, Javier. Thank you very much, Javier. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Arnaud Bourguin of Amundi Asset Management. Please go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my questions. I want to understand first if you already have the agreement from the shareholder for the capital increase. And I want to understand how did you calibrate the amount exactly? What are the driving for this size of capital increase? Thanks.
Great. I shall leave that with Javier, I think.
Okay. I think it's worth clarifying. This is not money flowing directly from our ultimate shareholders. This is money coming from debt investors. We are restoring the fourth layer of debt that we used to have until March 2019. So this is provided by private debt infrastructure investors. And to be honest, it has been size based on conversations on their appetite and ours. So this is their opportunity to upsize that even further. But I think at this stage, we believe that was the right size considering the traffic forecast that we are seeing.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Leo Jesser of MFS. Please go ahead.
Hello, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I want to continue building on this ADI loan. And it is how, first of all, how is the money moving on to the other layers at Heathrow? Is it a subordinated loan or is it an equity contribution per se? And the second question is about your strategy for the future. Given that your shareholders have not contributed a single penny so far, before the crisis, your debt has just increased year on year, and as the business was growing, that was less of a concern to everyone involved. Now that we see that your revenue can come down a little as well, will you prioritize debt reduction before restarting dividends in the future, given that everything that you've borrowed this year is essentially dead money to keep you alive rather than invest in the business?
Thank you for those, Leo. Harry, do you want to cover those 2 points?
Yeah. So I think in terms of IDA finance too long, this is exactly the same structural, it's exactly the same feature that we used to have in March 2019. So this is subordinated to the other three layers of debt that we have, senior, junior, and Heathrow Finance. And in terms of how the money flows, obviously it will be cascaded down through the structure through a combination of capital injection and intercompany loans. But in practical terms, that means that for purposes of our financing documentation, it works as equity injection into the Heathrow Finance Group. In terms of strategy for the future, well, let me start by respectfully disagreeing about your statement that shareholders are not contributing. Actually, in fact, as John has mentioned, today we have posted a £1.5 billion losses. And those £1.5 billion losses are actually funded by shareholders. The other important thing is one of the fundamental strengths of Heathrow through this crisis is the phenomenal liquidity. And that phenomenal liquidity is a combination of support by yourself and creditors, as well as shareholders. So Heathrow has always had a very prudent liquidity policy. We are constantly having at least 18 months liquidity. And in comparison with other infrastructure business, shareholders have taken the view in other businesses to extract every penny out of the group. In our case, shareholders have been very responsible and supportive to leave that liquidity into the company, and that's why we haven't faced the need to rush for equity injection because the equity was already in the company. Having said that, obviously, as part of the documentation and the waiver that all of you supported in July, we have a very clear constraint. There will be no dividends until at least the 87.5% gearing level is restored. So therefore, until the Heathrow doesn't go back to the stability of our capital structure pre-COVID, there will be no dividend distribution. So I can give you comfort for that.
Great. Thank you, Javier.
Thank you. We have time for one more question from the line of Paul Dew of FMR. Please go ahead.
Hi, Paul.
Thank you. Hi. Thank you very much for your questions, and thanks for all the work you've been doing over the last few months. Three questions, if I may. One on OPEX. So what do you need to do to reach the £300 million target for the year end? What's remaining? And then a small one actually on CapEx as well. Does the CapEx guidance for this year and next year remain the same? Any comments you could give on October trends in passengers, if there's been any change from as the restrictions have come back in? And then the final one, just on the ADI facility again, would you be able to give some color on the terms? Is there a maturity on that facility? And I'm assuming that because of the cash lockup, no cash can go out of the finance, the SP level at the moment to service that. So I'm just wondering how that loan will be serviced and how that works. Thank you very much.
Great. Good questions, Paul. So let me cover OPEX and what we're seeing in terms of current trading, and then perhaps Harry can pick up on CAPEX and ADI. From an OPEX point of view, we have done what we need to do to deliver the 300 million, and now we're looking to go beyond that. And that is at a net OPEX level. So actually, we're making very good progress. And from the latest figures I've seen, we are ahead of our European counterparts in reducing OPEX. And of course, now we're thinking about next year. Some of the temporary facilities that were in place for this year, such as the government's furlough scheme, won't be available. So we're looking at other measures that will allow us to take cost out, and the kind of changes around our payroll costs is an example of how we are doing that. In terms of the current activity, we've seen pretty stable levels of traffic week on week over the last 6 to 8 weeks, and our forecast that we announced today assumes that will continue to be the case through until about March of next year, and we're not forecasting any material recovery before then. Now, if we move to testing in December, as the Secretary of State has said, that could put us ahead of that. But we really have to wait and see, and I think it's best to be cautious and just build in the things that we can be confident of based on activity, and not build in any things that rely on third parties at this stage. So, Javi, do you want to pick up the other 2 points on CapEx and how ADIS will work?
Yeah. So thank you, Paul. So on CapEx, yes, I think that we maintain the same guidance as before. So for the years 2020 and 2021, we had £802 million. Probably we are going to bring slightly more CapEx into 2020, around £15 million, simply because it was more cost effective to do it this year. But for the combined of the 2 years, we remain working to have no more than £802 million of CapEx. In terms of ADI Finance 2, obviously it's a private facility, so I'm afraid I cannot give you many details of the terms of the loan, but I can tell you that it's a 7-year term debt. And in terms of some of the characteristics is that we will be capitalizing some of the interest over the first couple of years, and from there we will pay as it becomes due.
Great, thank you, Javier. And Paul, I hope that was helpful. Well,
thank you very much.
Close by thanking everyone for taking the time today to join us, for the support that you've shown us over the past few years, and in particularly this current year. These are clearly difficult times, but we will come through this, and I hope you can get confidence that we are taking all the actions you would hope we would be taking to protect the business, be cautious about the market, but really start to influence the things that can make a real difference, and in particular, the move towards testing. So thank you for this, and we'll look forward to our next update in a few months' time. Thank you.
This now concludes our conference call. Thank you all for attending. You may now disconnect your lines.